Israeli airstrikes hit a mosque in Gaza.
The Israeli military says it found what it calls training materials for the October 7 attack in southern Israel that triggered the war against Gaza's Hamas rulers.
Plus, fighting continues in Ukraine.
What we know from the lead is that Russian forces had certain success, and a lot of people, servicemen, Russian servicemen, are involved in this Avdiivka assault. And at this point, just today, there were footage of Ukrainian soldiers still in Avdiivka, so it's not completely captured by Russian forces.
And later, a look at a Senate bill aimed at curbing immigration across America's southern border, and the president of Namibia has died. Today is Monday, February 5th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint. Global crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Following a weekend of American strikes against Iran-backed militants in retaliation for an attack in Jordan that left three U.S. soldiers dead, fighting continues in Gaza. Dozens are dead and scores injured following an Israeli airstrike that damaged a mosque. The U.S. is trying to de-escalate tensions by sending the Secretary of State back to the region. The AP's Charles de Ledesma has the details.
Strikes hit two houses and a mosque in central Gaza on Sunday, killing around 30 people and wounding at least 60 others. Separate airstrikes in Rafah, the enclave's southernmost city, killed two children, ages 12 and 2, according to a hospital. The Israeli military says it found what it calls training materials for the October 7 attack in southern Israel that triggered the war against Gaza's Hamas rulers. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is returning to the region beginning Monday in Saudi Arabia. He also has stops scheduled in Egypt, Gaza, Israel, and the West Bank this week. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
With both a show of military might and a stronger push for a diplomatic solution, the United States is trying to contain a broader war in the Middle East. With the backdrop of Israel's war against Hamas, Iran-backed forces in the region are committed to continuing their attacks against Western interests. Here's VOA's Veronica Balderas-Iglesias with a story.
Even after a U.S.-led coalition successfully struck 36 Houthi targets in Yemen on Saturday, the United States can't rule out more attacks by the Houthis or by Iran-backed militias in the Middle East, warned National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan on ABC's This Week's show.
The central purpose of the strikes has been to take away capabilities from the Iranian-backed militias in Iraq and Syria that are attacking our forces and from the Houthis that continue to threaten Red Sea shipping. And we believe they had good effect in reducing, degrading the capabilities of the militias and of the Houthis. And as necessary, we will continue to take action.
But the Houthis have vowed to continue their military operations, which they affirm are in retaliation for Israel's war against Hamas targets in Gaza. More than 27,000 Palestinians have been caught in the crossfire and killed, and more than 66,000 injured, according to the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry. Yemeni Minister of State Nabil Mohsen Abu Nashtan.
What we see of aggression, siege, genocide, and a medicine blockade on our brothers in Gaza, citizens of Yemen, its tribes, weapons, and men are getting ready to face this aggression and do what they can.
Israel's military campaign was launched in response to the Hamas terrorist incursion into Israeli territory on October 7. Some 1,200 people were killed in that attack, and 240 more were taken captive. On Sunday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said 17 out of 24 Hamas battalions have been toppled so far.
Most of the remaining battalions are in the southern Gaza Strip and in Rafah, and we will take care of them too.
The U.S. is boosting its push for a diplomatic solution to the conflict with a new visit by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken to the region. A multi-stage proposal for extended pauses in fighting and the release of hostages in exchange for Palestinian prisoners in Israel is also in the works. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan spoke about the matter on ABC.
The president has put his shoulder to the wheel on this. He has spoken to the leaders of both Qatar and Egypt, two countries that are centrally involved in trying to broker this deal. We are in constant contact with our Israeli counterparts on it. And Hamas will have to be willing to say yes to an arrangement that brings hostages home.
Sullivan noted the deal isn't imminent and no timetable can be provided. His remarks came after the United Nations warned Friday that the Rafah border area in particular is becoming, quote, a pressure cooker of despair for displaced Palestinians in Gaza. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Shifting gears now, we take a look at immigration and the southern border of the United States. Acquiescing to Republican demands, the U.S. Senate has advanced a bill that would combine financial support for Ukraine, Israel, and the Indo-Pacific with border security. However, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives now say they won't support it. Explaining it all is VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson.
So before we get to the bill, Republicans have made an issue of immigration. In the last election, they talked about the caravan of migrants during Trump's administration. It's clearly a big issue for Republicans, as it is for many people in the country. But is it a crisis that America faces right now?
That's an excellent question, because we're so mired in the political debate here in this country that depending on who you ask, it's either a crisis or it's not a crisis. What you will hear on Capitol Hill, acknowledgement from both sides of the aisle, Democrats and Republicans, is that America's immigration system is long overdue for an overhaul. And so a major piece of legislation on immigration hasn't been passed since the late 1980s when Ronald Reagan was president. And so really what we're working with here in this country is an outdated system. Republicans would argue that that means that it's a crisis. Democrats often say that it's a very serious problem. So, you know, it's a matter, as always, of how political speech works. But both sides know that there really need to be some changes.
Okay, fair enough. So crisis or very serious problem, it's something that needs to be worked on.
Absolutely.
This bill where immigration reform was tied to President Biden's desire for aid to Ukraine and aid to Israel, what did it include? What were the changes that Republicans had in this bill?
So one of the things that was negotiated in this bipartisan agreement is that it would fund an ICE detention capacity from 34,000 to 50,000. So ICE is the Immigration and Customs Enforcement branch of the U.S. government that handles immigration. So there would be an increased capacity for detaining migrants. It would also mean that people who arrive in the U.S. undocumented, illegally, would not be able to claim amnesty. And this has been an issue with Mexico's government. It would force the U.S. government to shut down the border when there is a 7-day rolling average of 5,000 encounters per day, or 8,500 encounters in a single day. So Mexico's president last week was saying that this is simply untenable, that this would shut down commerce between the U.S. and Mexico, and that this is a non-starter for his country.
So the immigration details aside, what's really interesting about this whole thing is the politics of it. Democrats agreed to much more than they ever have in terms of conservative immigration policies. And they came up with this bipartisan agreement. Joe Biden said he likes it. As it's ready to go to the House of Representatives for their work on it, suddenly Donald Trump says no.
Well, the process here is a little bit different. So we had the text of the Senate bill released Sunday night. Chuck Schumer, the Senate majority leader, said that that will come up for a vote in the U.S. Senate as early as this Wednesday. If it passes as it's expected to, it will then go to the U.S. House of Representatives, where Speaker Mike Johnson has already said he will not take it up for a vote. It's a non-starter. Now, we've heard some different things from presumptive presidential candidate Donald Trump, who has said that it really depends on what kind of a bill it is. You know, this is him talking before he'd seen the text of the actual bill. There's been some talk that he's also encouraged Republicans behind the scenes not to vote for it. Because, of course, as you mentioned, this is a important campaign issue for Americans. And we're moving into a very busy presidential election season where it could be beneficial to keep this issue going on. So,
well, how so? This is something that Republicans have been fighting for a long time, no?
That is correct. That is absolutely correct. So it's a matter of, do you negotiate in politics? Do you accept compromise? Or do you not get anything of what you wanted and continue fighting on for another day?
I also find it interesting that the aid for Ukraine and Israel is still hanging in the balance of all this. Clearly, that's an important topic to people on both sides of the aisle.
That's absolutely right. And that's really where all of this got started is, you know, Republican support for another round of aid to Ukraine decreased over the course of 2023. And a lot of Republicans were saying, look, I no longer want to vote for this, sending more money to conflicts overseas where we don't have a strategy or what they argue is not a strategy. In when we have these domestic security issues at the border, they offered their votes to pass more aid to Ukraine in return for their asks on border security.
And we'll leave it there for today. Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. Catherine, thanks for your reporting on this.
You're so welcome.
Many of those who've been trying to enter the United States were fleeing violence in El Salvador. Recently, President Nayib Bukele has made the country much safer, but at the expense of civil liberties, democratic values, and the economy. Reuters' Alice Rizzo has that story.
Thousands of supporters rallied in San Salvador's central square to celebrate President Nayib Bukele's re-election on Sunday. The 42-year-old secured a thumping victory after voters cast aside concerns about erosion of democracy to reward him for a fierce gang crackdown.
This sería la primera vez que en un país existe un partido único en un sistema plenamente democrático.
This will be the first time where one sole party rules a country in a completely democratic system. We pulverized all of the opposition.
Quedó pulverizada.
Today, El Salvador made history once again.
Ha vuelto a hacer historia.
El Salvador's Supreme Electoral Tribunal last year permitted him to run for a second term, even though the country's constitution prohibits it. Opponents fear Bukele will seek to rule for life.
Empezamos a vencer nuestro más grande mal. Y estamos a punto de ganar la guerra contra las pandillas.
We have started to defeat our biggest evil. We are on the cusp of winning the war against the gangs. Literally. It's not an exaggeration. It's not a hyperbole. Literally, we went from being the most dangerous country in the world to being the most secure in all of the Western Hemisphere.
A ser el país más seguro de todo el hemisferio occidental.
Few doubted the outcome of the elections. Polls showed most voters wanted to reward Bukele for decimating the crime groups that made life intolerable in El Salvador and fueled waves of migration to the United States. Bukele campaigned on the success of his security strategy. Under him, authorities suspended civil liberties to arrest more than 75,000 Salvadorans without charges. The detentions led to a sharp decline in nationwide murder rates and fundamentally altered a country of 6.3 million people that was once among the world's most dangerous. But some analysts have said the mass incarceration of 1% of the population is not sustainable long term. Rights groups fear El Salvador's democracy is under attack. Another challenge will be the economy. Extreme poverty has doubled and private investment has tumbled under Bukele. The IMF, which is negotiating a $1.3 billion bailout with El Salvador, late last year described the country's fiscal situation as fragile.
Que Dios los bendiga a todos y muchas gracias.
That's Reuters' Alice Rizzo reporting. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We've got an update from our correspondent in Kyiv coming up in just a moment. But first, this look at the United Nations highest court, the International Court of Justice. In a recent ruling, it says it does have jurisdiction to rule on a request by Ukraine for a declaration saying that it's not responsible for genocide, the justification offered by the Kremlin ahead of the 2022 invasion. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Rescue workers extract bodies in the aftermath of a shelling attack in eastern Ukraine. In this Russian-occupied city in the Luhansk region, Moscow-installed officials say the attack killed at least 28 people in a bakery with at least one child among the dead. Ukrainian officials offered no comment. The news follows Ukraine's claim earlier this past week of sinking a Russian warship in the Black Sea. VOA cannot independently verify the date, location, or circumstances in the video. The Associated Press reporting private security firm Ambry says Ukraine used as many as 6 sea drones, each of which typically carries some 300 kilograms of explosives. This time, it was Russian officials offering no comment. It was against this backdrop of increasingly long-range attacks amid a mostly stalled Ukrainian counteroffensive that officials last week gathered at the United Nations top court. At The Hague in the Netherlands, the seat of the International Court of Justice, or ICJ, the body said it has jurisdiction to rule on a request by Ukraine saying it was not responsible for genocide. Russia used that claim to launch its invasion of Ukraine nearly 2 years ago. Ukrainian officials were quick to praise the decision. Ukrainian representative at the ICJ, Anton Korinovich, had a news conference as provided by the Associated Press.
Today is another important day in the International Court of Justice. Today the court announced its decision that it has jurisdiction to proceed to the merits stage in the case Ukraine versus the Russian Federation on the allegations of genocide.
While a legally binding decision is likely still years away, Moscow says the court has no jurisdiction in the matter. And while U.S. support for Ukraine is stuck in congressional partisan gridlock, the European Union last week announced a robust 4-year, $54 billion aid package for Ukraine. The president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, at a European Union news conference as provided by the Associated Press.
Today is indeed a very special day. The European Council reconfirmed Europe's unwavering commitment to stand with Ukraine. We all know that Ukraine is fighting for us, so we will support them with the necessary funding and provide them with the much-needed predictability they deserve.
Meanwhile, at a field hospital just a few kilometers from frontline fighting, injured soldiers arrive in need of medical attention. One soldier describes increasingly closer explosions until one struck his position, saying his leg then moved wherever it liked. And for those stationed on the southeastern front, a visit from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, in which he handed out medals to soldiers near a position once occupied by Russian forces. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Updating us on the fighting in Ukraine is our Kyiv correspondent, Anna Chernikova. She's talking with VOA's Steve Miller.
Anna, over the weekend, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visited the front lines. A video shows him there speaking with the troops, but this is coming at a time where there's also a very public disagreement, shall we call it, between he and one of his top military leaders. How is that playing out in the public sphere?
Well, it's actually perceived quite negatively within the society because according to the latest surveys that were published by the independent institutes in Ukraine, Valery Zaluzhny, who is a current commander-in-chief of the armed forces of Ukraine, he has the most support from people. So he has, if I'm not mistaken, over 70% support, and it's the most support any of the either military or political leader has currently in Ukraine. And of course, it's not quite, you know, quite a big surprise because as experts and as analysts, during the war, it's very quite normal that military leader has more support and more positive attitude towards him or her than political leaders. We can say that Of course, people are scared. People have this, you know, fear that if Zaluzhny is gone, then Ukraine might not be able to continue, you know, to fight and continue this, successful fight with Russia. If we look at it like Ukraine survived, so for people in Ukraine, it's already a success that Ukraine survived and that Ukraine is still alive.
And the time that we have left, what can you share with us about some of the fighting
in the area of Avdiivka? Is really the situation is changing every hour, so it's really difficult to be sure that the latest we have available is the actual state. What we know from the latest that Russian forces had certain success, and a lot of people, servicemen, Russian servicemen are involved in this Avdiivka assault. And at this point, just today, there were footage of Ukrainian soldiers still in Avdiivka. So it's not completely captured by Russian forces, but it looks like that situation is extremely, extremely critical for Ukrainian forces. Ukrainian forces, according again to what we know from the latest, are trying to keep their defense positions or are trying to prepare new defense positions to be able to remain certain control in that area.
Anna Chernikova reports for us from Kyiv, Ukraine. And as always, we thank you for your reporting.
Thank you, Steve.
Steve Miller is the host of Flashpoint Ukraine here on VOA. He was speaking with Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. And finally today, the death of Namibia's president, Hage Geingob, was announced on Sunday. Reuters' Trevor Carroll reports on what happens next.
A significant political shift is potentially on the horizon in Namibia following the death of President Hage Geingob in office. Geingob died age 82 in the early hours of Sunday after a brief battle with cancer. It was announced in an address by the nation's acting president, Nangolo Mbumba.
The president of the Republic of Namibia has passed on today. The Namibian nation has lost a distinguished servant of the people, a liberation struggle icon, the chief architect of our constitution, and the pillar of the Namibian house.
Mbumba said he had no plans to run in elections due at the end of the year. That opens the door for Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah, who replaces Mbumba as vice president. She was nominated by the governing Southwest Africa People's Organization, or SWAPO, just over a year ago to be its candidate and will remain on the ballot. SWAPO's constitution forbids making changes once the candidate has been picked 2 years before the poll is due. If she wins, she will be the Southern African nation's first female president. The party has ruled Namibia since independence from South Africa in 1990. Residents in capital Windhoek said Geingob's death is a big loss for the country.
He believed in equality, he believed in peace, he believed in all these qualities that a human being should actually live for.
Geingob leaves a middle-income Namibia grappling with post-pandemic economic slowdown, striving to surpass 3% growth, and addressing lingering racial inequalities from colonial and South African white minority rule. Under his leadership, Namibia became the first African country in 2022 to supply the European Union with green hydrogen and minerals crucial for clean energy.
That's Trevor Kroll of Reuters reporting for us. And that's going to end today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.